So welcome to the show. The best around, it just depends if I'm in your town.
All right, welcome back to The Deep Dive. We're kicking off something pretty fascinating today, a new series. And this was the first part of our vitamin take series. It's basically going to be your ultimate guide to understanding these essential nutrients, vitamins D, A, K, and E. So get ready, because we're going to do a full deep dive on each one. And today we're starting with part one, which is all about the mysterious and often misunderstood vitamin D.
That's right. And for this first vitamin D deep dive, we have a really important goal. We want to help you truly understand what this nutrient is all about. We'll be exploring its true nature and the evidence for why it's so crucial for our health. And along the way, we're going to try to unpack this ongoing debate. Is it truly a vitamin, or does it actually act more like a hormone?
Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the things that makes vitamin D so fascinating is that it has this dual source. It's not just about what we eat. Our bodies can actually produce vitamin D from sunlight. It's one of the few nutrients we can get this way. So right off the bat, that makes you wonder, maybe there's more to its story than just a typical vitamin.
Exactly. And as we get deeper into this, you'll discover that vitamin D's story goes way beyond just strong bones. We're going to uncover some surprising roles it plays in our immune system, and there's even growing research suggesting it might even influence our nervous system. So get ready to rethink everything you thought you knew about this essential nutrient as we kick off our Vitamin Dyke series.
Okay, let's jump right into it then. This whole vitamin or hormone question, I hear it all the time. I'm curious, where did this idea of vitamin D even come from in the first place?
Well, we have to go back in time a bit. The discovery of vitamin D goes back to the early 1900s. At that time, scientists were trying to figure out what caused rickets, which is a pretty serious bone disease that affects children. And they eventually pinpointed it to a lack of a certain factor that could be obtained through diet.
So it started with observing a deficiency, and that missing element was then labeled as a vitamin.
Right, and that's how it earned its initial classification as a vitamin. But then, as research progressed, it became clear that vitamin D wasn't acting quite like other vitamins. Researchers started understanding it as a prohormone.
A prohormone. So is that like a pre-vitamin or something?
It's more like a precursor. A prohormone is a substance that needs to undergo some transformations within the body to become its active form. And that active form is what really exerts the effects.
So the vitamin D we get from sunlight or a supplement, that's not the one doing all the work right away.
Nope, not in its initial form. It needs a couple of steps inside the body to become fully functional. And here's where it gets really interesting. Our bodies can actually produce most of the vitamin D we need through sunlight exposure. Dietary intake from food only accounts for about 10% of our total vitamin D. That ability to produce it internally is a key characteristic of hormones, not typically vitamins.
Wow, 10%, that's a big difference. So tell me more about this active form. What is it called and what does it actually do in the body?
The active form of vitamin D is called calcitriol. And this is where the magic happens. Calcitriol acts on different biological processes throughout the body. Most notably, it regulates calcium levels, but it also plays a key role in regulating our immune system. And some research even suggests it might impact our nervous system. These widespread actions are much more characteristic of a hormone.
Okay, to clear things up, let's take a step back. How do we define a vitamin? And what exactly is a hormone? What are the key differences between them?
That's a really important question. So traditionally, vitamins are defined as organic compounds that our bodies need in small amounts. They often act as what we call enzyme cofactors. Think of them as helpers that allow enzymes to carry out important chemical reactions. A good example is vitamin C, which helps in the production of collagen, or the B vitamins, which are involved in energy metabolism.
Right, they're like the behind-the-scenes crew for our body's essential functions.
Exactly. Now, hormones are different. They're like messengers, chemical messengers. They're produced by glands in our endocrine system, and they travel through the bloodstream to different parts of the body. Their job is to regulate things like growth, metabolism, and reproduction. They do this by signaling cells to do specific actions. Think of insulin, which controls blood sugar, or estrogen and testosterone, which influence sexual characteristics. These are classic examples of hormones.
So to recap, vitamins typically come from outside the body, mainly from our diet, and they assist in processes, whereas hormones are produced inside the body and send signals.
Yes, that's a good summary of the traditional understanding. And a key difference has always been where they come from. We obtain vitamins from our diet, and hormones are made within the body.
But this is where vitamin D seems to break that rule, right?
It does. Vitamin D challenges this nice and neat categorization. We can get it from our diet, sure, but we also make it ourselves through sunlight exposure. And then it gets converted into that active form, calcitriol, which acts on receptors inside our cells. This means it actually modulates gene expression. In other words, it can influence which genes are turned on or off. That's a very hormone-like action, directly affecting our genetic code to create changes.
Okay, so let's dive deeper into the vitamin D as a vitamin argument. Even though we're talking about it acting like a hormone, there were good reasons why it was classified as a vitamin initially, right?
Absolutely. It's important to remember the historical context. As we mentioned, vitamin D was discovered because it prevented those deficiency diseases like rickets, which causes soft and weak bones in kids, and osteomalacia, which affects adults. Those conditions were clearly linked to not getting enough of a specific dietary factor.
So at the time, it fit the criteria of a vitamin, a dietary component needed for health, the absence of which leads to specific diseases.
Exactly. And we do still obtain vitamin D through our diet. You find it in fortified foods like milk and cereals, and also in fatty fish like salmon. And of course, there are supplements. If you're not getting enough sun, taking a vitamin D supplement can help.
And then there's the sunlight connection. Our skin actually produces vitamin D. How does that whole process work?
When our skin is exposed to UVB rays from the sun, a type of cholesterol in our skin called 7D hydrocholesterol gets converted into cholecalciferol, which is vitamin D3. This is a major way we get vitamin D, highlighting that we're not completely reliant on external sources like most vitamins.
And we hear about vitamin D2 and D3. What's the difference between those two?
So vitamin D2 or urocalciferol, you mainly find that in fungi and fortified foods. Vitamin D3, or cholecalciferol, is the one our skin makes, and you find it in animal-based foods. D3 is generally considered to be more effective at raising and maintaining vitamin D levels in the body. But you're right, the fact that we have both these dietary and internal sources from sunlight further supported its initial classification as a vitamin.
All right, so we've explored why it got labeled a vitamin. Now let's look at the other side. What are the main arguments for considering vitamin D a hormone?
The strongest argument for vitamin D being a hormone really centers on how its active form, calcitriol, works. We've talked about how calcitriol acts very much like a classic steroid hormone. It travels in the bloodstream and it binds to something called the vitamin D receptor, or VDR, which is found inside almost every cell in our body. This binding to the VDR then has a direct effect on gene expression. It can actually switch genes on or off, telling the cell to produce more or less of certain proteins that carry out various functions.
So it's not just assisting an enzyme, it's directly giving instructions to our genes, influencing what they do.
That's right. And its primary role, this is important, is regulating calcium and phosphate homeostasis. And it does this by acting on the intestines, increasing their absorption of these minerals, acting on the kidneys to reduce their excretion, and also working on the bones to regulate the release and uptake of calcium and phosphate. This intricate control over mineral balance is a hallmark of hormonal systems.
And you mentioned earlier that it needs to be activated. It's not like you just swallow some vitamin D or get some sun and it's immediately active, right?
You got it. It's actually a two-step activation process. First, whether it's from the skin or our diet, vitamin D gets converted in the liver to 25-hydroxyvitamin D. It's also called calciferol. This is the form that doctors usually measure in blood tests to assess your vitamin D status. Think of it as the first stage of activation.
Got it. So the liver produces calciferol. Then what?
Then calciferol travels to the kidneys. And in the kidneys, there's another enzyme that adds a second hydroxyl group, converting calciferol into the active form, calcitriol. So it's a journey with multiple stops before it becomes fully functional.
So two steps, first in the liver, then the kidneys, and that's where it reaches its final active hormone-like form.
That's exactly right. And this active calcitriol, it doesn't just float around aimlessly. It binds to those vitamin D receptors, the VDRs, which are found in tons of different cell types all over the body. And when it binds, it can change gene expression. It's like a key fitting into a lock on your DNA, telling the cell to make more or less of certain proteins. And those proteins then go on to do all sorts of things, from helping with bone mineralization to influencing immune cell activity and cell growth.
And earlier you mentioned its actions on things like calcium absorption and retention, and also bone growth. Can you break down how it regulates those processes?
Sure. So calcitriol, the active form, it enhances calcium absorption from the food we eat. This happens in the intestines. It also promotes calcium retention in the kidneys, which means we lose less calcium in our urine. And when it comes to our bones, calcitriol plays a key role in regulating both osteoglasts, which are the cells that build new bone, and osteoclasts, which break down old bone. So it helps maintain the balance between building up and breaking down bone, which is essential for strong and healthy bones.
You also mentioned the feedback loops, which are really important in hormonal systems. How does our body make sure we have enough vitamin D, but not too much?
Well, it's a very finely tuned system. Calcitriol actually helps regulate its own production. When calcitriol levels are high, it can inhibit the enzymes that make more calcitriol and even promote its own breakdown. It also interacts with other hormones like parathyroid hormone, or PTH, and fibroblast growth factor 23, or FGF23, to carefully control calcium and phosphate balance. For example, when calcium levels are low, PTH steps in and stimulates the production of calcitriol. And then when calcium levels are back up, calcitriol can suppress PTH production. It's a really amazing dance of regulation.
Sounds like a pretty intricate system with lots of checks and balances.
You got it. And we should also remember that calcitriol can act locally in specific cells too, like immune cells. It can modulate cytokine production in those cells and support our innate immune system. This localized action further reinforces its role as a hormone in regulating all sorts of physiological processes.
So it's clear why there's this debate about whether it's a vitamin or a hormone. It's not a simple answer. Can we talk more about the arguments from each side in this scientific debate?
Of course. A major point of contention is the traditional definition of vitamins. Originally, they were defined as essential nutrients that our bodies couldn't produce on their own, so we had to get them from our diet. Vitamin D challenges that because we can make it in our skin when exposed to sunlight. That's a fundamental difference.
Yeah, that's a big departure from the standard definition of a vitamin.
Right. On the other hand, you can't deny the hormone-like properties of vitamin D. It's a secosteroid, which is a type of steroid molecule, and it regulates calcium and bone metabolism by directly impacting gene expression, which is just like other steroid hormones do. And the fact that the active form, calcitriol, can be produced not only in the kidneys, but also locally in other tissues, acting on all sorts of biological processes, that really supports the hormone argument.
And what about those vitamin D receptors, those VDRs? They're everywhere, right?
They are, and that's a big clue. VDRs are found in so many different tissues, which means vitamin D can potentially influence hundreds of genes involved in all sorts of essential processes. Cell growth, cell differentiation, programmed cell death, apoptosis, and immune responses. This suggests a really broad regulatory role, similar to hormones.
But there's also the fact that vitamin D isn't released by a gland directly into the bloodstream like a typical hormone, right? That's a key difference.
Yeah, that's a major point that people bring up when arguing against calling it a true hormone. Unlike classic hormones, which are made and released by endocrine glands, vitamin D is produced in the skin or taken in from food and then needs those metabolic conversions to become active. Because of this, some people prefer the term prohormone. It starts in a less active form and needs those steps to become fully functional as a hormone.
And we talked briefly about its impact on sex hormones. Does that make it more likely to be classified as a hormone?
That's another interesting piece of the puzzle. Vitamin D does seem to be involved in the synthesis and regulation of sex hormones like estrogen and progesterone, which are crucial for reproductive health. But those effects are just one part of a larger picture. It's not really a primary sex hormone itself.
So it has this unique combination of characteristics that keeps the debate going. It acts like a hormone in many ways, but its origin and initial form are more aligned with a vitamin.
Exactly. And in the end, the specific label may be less important than understanding how crucial it is for our overall health.
Okay, let's talk about something practical, vitamin D supplementation. Considering everything we've discussed, how can supplementation help us?
The main goal of taking vitamin D supplements is to make sure we have enough of that circulating form, 25-OHD, in our blood. This is essential for supporting bone health and all those other functions we've been talking about. Supplementation with cholecalciferol or vitamin D3 is often recommended, especially for people who are deficient in vitamin D. It's crucial to prevent those classic deficiency diseases like rickets and osteomalacia.
What about athletes? We hear a lot about athletes and vitamin D. What's the connection there?
There's a lot of interest in the potential benefits of vitamin D supplements for athletes. Some studies have found that vitamin D supplementation might help improve muscle strength, reduce inflammation, and speed up recovery after intense exercise or injuries. But it's important to remember that research also shows that if someone already has enough vitamin D, taking more probably won't give them any extra benefits. It seems to be most helpful for those who are deficient or don't have optimal levels.
So it's more about correcting a deficiency rather than boosting performance in people who already have enough.
That's the general consensus. And the real benefits of supplementation become clear when we look at things like improving bone mineralization, reducing the risk of fractures, especially as we get older, and supporting immune function. We know that vitamin D helps regulate gene expression related to immune responses, which may even help reduce the risk of autoimmune diseases and infections. But research is still ongoing in these areas.
You mentioned something about baseline status being important. So if someone's already getting enough sun and has a diet rich in vitamin D, Does that mean taking extra vitamin D might not be necessary?
That's exactly right. If someone already has sufficient vitamin D levels, the benefits of taking extra vitamin D might not be very noticeable. That's why it's so important to know your own vitamin D levels. And when supplementation is needed, there are different dosing strategies. You can take it daily, weekly, or even monthly, which helps create a more personalized approach.
What about some of the bigger claims we hear about vitamin D, like preventing heart disease or multiple sclerosis? What's the evidence like for those?
Yeah, so some observational studies have shown potential connections between having healthy vitamin D levels and a lower risk of those conditions than others. But when we look at the results from the large randomized controlled trials, the evidence is mixed. Those trials don't consistently support the idea that taking vitamin D supplements can prevent those diseases in everyone. The current clinical guidelines really focus on vitamin D's well-established role in bone health and the importance of treating diagnosed deficiencies. The potential role of vitamin D supplementation in preventing diseases beyond bone health is still being actively researched and debated in the scientific community.
So it sounds like the main takeaway is that supplementation is really important for addressing deficiencies and maintaining good bone health and a healthy immune system. But for people who aren't deficient, the benefits of high-dose supplementation for preventing other diseases aren't clear yet.
That's a great summary. It highlights how important it is to make personalized healthcare decisions and to understand your own individual needs when it comes to vitamin D.
Well, this has been a truly enlightening deep dive into vitamin D, and this is just the beginning of our Vitamin D series.
That's right.
So let's quickly recap some of the key takeaways from today.
Sure. Vitamin D is a fascinating compound that really blurts the lines between what we traditionally think of as a vitamin and a hormone. Given how it's synthesized, how it needs to be activated, and its wide-ranging effects on the body, especially its direct role in influencing gene expression, it really acts more like a pro-hormone.
And regardless of what we call it, its role in bone health is absolutely crucial. And it's becoming increasingly clear that it plays a major role in our immune system. It's definitely not just about strong bones. It impacts so much more.
Exactly. And considering this dual nature, it really makes you wonder, how will our understanding and approach to maintaining optimal vitamin D levels change in the future? Should we maybe start thinking about it more like monitoring a hormone level rather than just making sure we get enough of a vitamin? It's a really important question to consider.
It definitely gives us all something to think about. And this was just the first part of our Vitamin Dake series. Next time, we'll be taking a deep dive into vitamin A. So make sure to join us for that. Thanks for tuning in to the Deep Dive. So welcome to the show. The best round.